This is CliffCentral.com.
Kagiso Lediga is an actor, comedian. We all know him very well. He's also become a television producer, a movie producer. He starred in a number of well-known shows. He was part of the Pio Monate show from 2003 to 4.
I think it's five.
Was it five?
Could have been. I just remember, because a lot of people keep asking, when is the season two coming back? But there were actually two seasons.
Well, I mean, that was such a long time ago, but that show has still got reputational cred.
That's crazy, yeah.
In a big way. Hey?
Yeah, yeah. It's actually quite amazing for me that it still has so much kind of force or clout or whatever.
Well, you know, I've said this to you before, so it's hardly news, but I think those moments are almost like cultural artifacts because that show was doing what nobody else at that time was doing. It was at a time in South Africa where we didn't have very many...
There were no outlets as well. I mean, there was only like SABC 1, 2, 3, and then like DSTV was still like a foreign, you know, Mnet. It was, so people on a Friday, I remember there used to be a lot of like Jewish mamas who used to like hail me down at the newly built Melrose Arch. And they would tell me all these bits. Yeah, exactly. And they would tell me all the bits from the show and I didn't understand. And then also because it was Shabbos, so they couldn't leave. And
they would watch.
Yeah, and they didn't have a lot to watch on TV. There was no Netflix. So that was very cool. Yeah,
but dude, I'm so amazed at I'm not amazed. I mean, this is kind of the obvious evolutionary trajectory for you. It was that you would end up producing movies, and you've done a couple of these now, and this one, Catching Feelings, is the one that we're going to talk about. But there's been Matwetwe
is actually so the Catching Feelings is the first one I directed.
Right.
And it's with Pearl too. I wrote the script and then I kind of hustled it. I spoke to people that I knew. I was kind of crowdfunding it, getting everybody to put $200,000 a pop.
Right.
Myself, another business partner, a guy called Ronnie Aptiaka, he got another guy and it was like a whole thing. And then out of the blue, we got a call from the IDC saying they kind of through the grapevine heard about the project. Can they get involved? And then everybody was like, hey, it means we don't have to spend our own money. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's speak to these guys. So they came to the party. It was cool. Like a sort of a 4.5 million rand gig. And my first time directing a film, starring in it and writing it.
And actually having like a reasonable budget. Because guys had been cobbling together the 200,000 like you had before in movies.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
like,
hard.
Yeah, it is. I mean, things like Bunny Chow and Wonder Boy for President. Mm-hmm. That's like pretty much credit cards extended.
Yeah, you had to fund Wonder Boy for President all on your own.
Yeah, with John Barker. Yeah, just the two of us. And I think a lot of times his wife is involved because, you know, it's her credit card a lot of times. But yeah, that one we took like 4 years to make and all of that. It was a lot of fun. It wasn't a money gig, you know.
No.
It was a telling gig. And so we made that film, Catching Feelings, and then it premiered at the LA Film Festival last year in June, and it was like, oh wow, this is actually, and then it kind of had its own life. But then 6 months before that, when we were kind of taking it to places, there wasn't any traction. And then I was just like, oh man, so much time spent. So I said over December, I said to my producing partner, who's also my life partner, I said to her, yo, let's make another movie. Screw these people. Screw these Americans and Europeans who are not going to let us in, you know? So we made this other film over December called Matwetwe, which is a project that I hold dear to my heart. And that one, so we finished it. And then as soon as we finished doing that and cutting it, Catching Feelings started getting traction. And then it got into the LA Film Festival and all sorts of places. And then Matwetwe now, I mean, it premiered at the Fantastic Fest, which is the biggest genre festival in America. And now it just came from a prestigious festival, Rotterdam Film Fest. I was there like two, three weeks ago. But this film was just crazy the way it came together.
I'm blown away by this. I mean, that's no small thing. If I'd told you 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, you're going to have a film at the LA Film Festival or in Rotterdam.
Yeah.
I mean, you would have said to me, bullshit.
I wouldn't have said bullshit, but I would have been like, wow, okay, cool. I mean, it's coming from Gareth Cliff.
Deal.
I mean, I'd be like, you'd be the oracle of Cliff has come down into the bedroom.
Like Nostradamus.
Yeah. But it was cool. I mean, it's a bit of work, but it's fun. You know, it's stuff that I like to do. It's like a lot of people ask, well, are you still a comedian? And of course, I'm totally a comedian, but it takes so much time. I'm actually a bit scared because making movies takes so much time. It's storytelling. I always call myself a storyteller. And it's storytelling of like a different kind, which involves a lot more people. So I'm writing my third film now, and as soon as I've handed in the second draft, I'm going back to stand up at least for a couple of months.
Because movies are also frustrating, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because there are all these other people, when you put together your own stand-up shows, it's just really you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can decide what you're going to put in there. You can decide what to take out. You can change it on a night-by-night basis if you like. You don't have to consult with a whole team of people. And you don't have money responsibilities towards other people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's no banks and IDCs and private investors going,
You, with a movie, you make a change to the script. Everybody's got to know about it.
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, that is it's great, the collaborativeness of it, but it also can be quite. So when I made Catching Feelings, because the IDC is involved and all of that kind of stuff, there's a guy, you know, they get you a guy who's going to be like a script guy, you know.
Advisor.
And I hate that because the guy, I'm like, I respect the guy as a human being, but not as a filmmaker. But you know what I mean? When do the two cross? Because when I disrespect him as a filmmaker, he takes it as disrespect for him as a human being. It's just crazy. So, but the project was cool. It ended up very, very cool. Whereas with my Twitter, there was nobody. It was just me. I mean, I'm broke now because I sunk a whole lot of cash into it. But it was fun. It's like rewarding. And
did you ever have that moment where before you put my Twitter to the wheel that you thought, I should rather just bank this money and like let my kids have a decent education?
I believe in the thing so much. And it's, you know, I just thought there was the kind of three of us who put in the money, and the independence and the experience is way way more than the money. I mean, like, so I believe that I'm going to get the money back, but then so far it's already like, what a dope bet, you know?
Right.
So that was very cool.
I'm happy to hear that because you'd hate the thing to go the other way.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you are, and I mean,
I mean, look, sometimes I look at it as like a couple of business class or first class flights to somewhere a couple of times, and then that money's finished again. So there's still, you know, it was a better ride than all of that so far.
But you love this. And I think it's a really powerful way for you to evolve what you're always, or what you've always been the best at, and what you can now do on a larger scale.
Yeah, I like that.
And I also think that there's an appetite now for our local production, our ability to tell our stories and to put our own spin on stories internationally, which there wasn't before.
Totally. Yeah, it's actually very what I thought. I mean, I always say that we as South Africans, we have like a national low self-esteem. Like because of apartheid and everything. I mean, we have, you know, we kind of, black people, because white people told them that they weren't worthy, black people kind of go, are we good enough? Are we good enough? And then white people, white South Africans, because they were excluded by the international community for so long, they also go, is it good enough?
A little bit of guilt and there's a little bit of like geography that's...
Exactly.
So I think we do have that insecurity complex. And I also think that that's the cause of why we spend so much of our time bickering with each other instead of doing stuff.
Yeah. And what's crazy is that our story is so dope. We're such a unique bunch of people that where it's always surprising. I mean, you do stand-up comedy anywhere else in the world, and then you tell these stories, and then you see them pop, you know?
Yeah.
And people are like, well, where the hell? Why did you tell us more? And then you put these movies out there, you know, because, I mean, we also tend to make things that are a bit insular, but I feel like if we tell our story without kind of, don't hold back, just tell the story to the world, you know? Don't just be like, okay, because it's a story about DJs Boo or Skumba or Gareth Cliff, it's only going to be relevant to people in the greater Rembeck region, you know? Tell it to the world. People go, wow, this I feel like that, doing that alone is like, it's so liberating, because then you get people kind of laughing at every bit, understanding all the bits. It's, for me, it's just been a great eye-opener.
Now, with Catching Feelings, did Pearl say she wanted to be involved from the get-go?
No. So what happened?
Negotiate.
I had a. So I wrote the script, and the script was doing its round. People were liking the script. You know, it was like a sophisticated script. You know, it was so sophisticated.
And who then, do you send this to? I mean, who are the people?
My immediate people who kind of, they're sort of consigliaries, who are going to be people who work in the industry, who are going to go, whoa, this is a thing, or they're going to go, you need a bit of work, you know. So that was luckily a lot of, whoa, this is a thing, you need to do this, but wow, this is actually a thing, because we haven't seen a thing like this in South Africa. And then so you kind of go, that's the inner circle, and then you send it to the next round of people, and they're like, have maybe a lot more financial influence, people like Ronnie Aptiaker and all of that kind of stuff. So he was like, whoa, Kiki, it's very nice. It's just a very sexy. It's a hell of a thing, Kiki. It's a hell of a thing.
And he's such a supporter of local cinema. And he's been trying so hard for everybody in the movie business in this country to get ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like the one man ambassador.
No, exactly. And he pushes. I mean, he's a partner on this. He's one of the EPs. And like, he was in Lagos yesterday. He called me from Lagos going, Kiki, I just want to know. I mean, are we doing a push on Twitter tonight? Kiki, please, we need to push us. 2 weeks to go. This is a hell of a thing. So he's very passionate. I mean, like, he's Riyadh can tell you the same through from material. You know, it's like he's a hard worker. And he says, I'm a Jew. I just nag, Kiki. I'm sorry, but I'm a Jew. I'm a nagger. So but it's a great ride, you know. And he does know how to get people to kind of get on board. He does know how to nag. I forgot what we were talking about.
We're talking about Pearl.
Oh yeah,
you want to tell me how Pearl came?
So I had somebody else who was going to be in the film. I was sold on this person, and then people kept on saying, "But what about Pearl?" And I was like, "Pearl is a bit of a pop star type of character. This is a sophisticated movie, man. You know, Pearl is, you know." I was just like, "Oh man, no." And then Roy Loiso was kind of close with Pearl. He was very close to Pearl, and he said, "What about Pearl?" I was like, "Come on, man, this is a sophisticated movie." And he said, "Come on, let's just give her a script and see, you know, because she's working on this kind of stuff and so on and so forth." So Pearl read for it, but then she also got distracted with her superstar life. And then I was like, see, I told you, it's not the kind of thing for Pearl. And then eventually he went and said, "Yo, man," he told her, and then like, kind of, you know, "You need to be more serious about this. I really think you should be in it, you know." So she came, and I was still like, I was already set on my person. And then Pearl came, I read with her on camera, and it was like,
you just knew.
I mean, everybody in the room was like, see? And then she came on board, and she's one thing about her, like, she's a really hard worker, you know. She takes this acting thing very seriously. I mean, at the same time we were shooting this film, that's when she also got my sister to audition her for Quantico, and she got the part. Oh, wow. And she's like very, it was a killer. She destroyed. I mean, it was really, really good. And on screen, I mean, like, all over the... I mean, I've watched this film with people in Los Angeles. I've watched this movie with people in New York City. And people just go, wow, that woman. I mean, she's just so electric on screen, you know?
She's got something special.
Yeah.
There's definitely, like, people don't just become a big deal out of nowhere.
You gotta have that thing, that certain magic, that Muhammad Ali thing, you know, like, I think she's got that. You're right, the people who have those, people who are sort of in 4K, and then there's the rest of us who are in standard definition. And we're still showing, but it just doesn't have that.
I think you're being self-effacing.
Well, I
see you as developing into this kind of Spike Lee-esque character.
Oh, wow, thank you. Yeah,
in all the best ways, because Spike Lee really did, I mean, not so long ago, but a long time ago by our standards, he did a wonderful thing for cinema.
He did
a wonderful thing for black cinema. He did a lovely thing for independent cinema at a time where it wasn't easy to do.
No, I remember when I saw Do the Right Thing for the first time. Yeah. I was at university. I was at UCT living in a house in Woodstock. It was a really cool house that the dude he was sort of my landlord, was a guy called Peter Bester. And his job was he was a diamond diver. So most days, most weeks, he would be out in Angola diving for diamonds. And then I had this house that he had souped up. Well, not a big, it was like pre-gentrified Woodstock, Cape Town. And this house, he had done all, it had like this little sort of loft room. It had like these railway sleeping. It was really like he had taken a lot of care. And there I was, this was my house, you know.
Right.
I was like second year university. And
best digs in Cape Town.
It was unbelievable, you know. And then I had the small bedroom, I mean the small small TV, like one of these, a small color TV, portable. And that's where I watched. I used to smoke a lot of doob as well at the time. And that's where I remember watching Do the Right Thing. Yep. First, like, and I was just like, how did I never watch this before? You know? And it's been my, yeah, it's one of the greatest films ever made, I think.
And he's indisputably one of the best directors of all time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the reason I draw the comparison is because I sense in you, like, you can still pull that crazy character stuff that you used to do when you were doing comedy, and you probably still do if you're doing stand-up. And it still works. It's still as relevant as ever, and I know you keep up to date. Yeah. And you're very much involved.
I try.
No, well, I mean, you're involved in current affairs. You know who the other comics are. You go to a lot of these things. It's like a brotherhood, really.
Yeah. But
you also have now suddenly this quite serious, quite business-like tone to you, which I haven't seen before.
Oh.
Yeah, and I mean, I spoke to you, 2 years ago,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
And
Two, 3 years.
And I've always held you in high regard from a standpoint of this is a performer.
Yeah, which I've always acknowledged. Yeah, yeah. Right, I mean, we have a common friend, that David Kibuga, as well. And
of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Another guy who we have a lot of respect for. But I notice in you now that there's this edge of kind of, I have an important task to do that falls outside of being the clown.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And this is what I want to do. This storytelling, this production, this directing. I mean, directing is hard.
It's a thing, yeah. It's very time consuming. Especially when you write the things. So I directed these two films, which I'm very proud of. And they're going to come out. You're going to see. You're going to get to experience them. But I also do, you know, I've tried to do directing for sort of commercials. I've been called in there, and it's very strange, man. It's really not in my, you know what I mean? Because you have to pitch somebody else's idea to them. It's like, you have an idea of what you want, but then I have to come and tell it to you. And then you go, that's not what I have in my mind. I'm like, yeah, but then why didn't you do it yourself, you little...
And especially when the subject matter is something like a pizza.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to film
chicken.
Yeah, chicken. You have to film a chicken burger and then make it pop.
Yeah, and then you come with it. You reckon, they called me, so maybe they want a bit of what I do. So then you go, yes, this, you know, jet, let's set it in a this and a that in a train station, because that's where people who wear jets are, you know, they're in train stations and they're in taxis, and it's going to be cool. They're like, no, it's not, nah, it's not, plant is not, plant,
plant
nah.
Is not
plant
happy.
Is not going to like that. So there's that. And then, I mean, I've also done like the late night news with Loy, which was for me very, for me, you know what? I don't know. I think I told you, I think that's the last time I spoke to you about this. You had just opened the station, and you had Julius Malema was like another type of, he was still a different variation. He was,
He just started the EFF.
Yeah. He was more kind of like a lot more of a firebrand, right? He was a lot more kind of rock and roll. And I remember with Late Night News, the whole idea, because Julius Malema had so much voice, and he was this representative of the youth, but he also didn't necessarily represent me, you know? But that was like, great that the guy like this is around. But what do we do? I'm not a politician, but I love politics, but I don't, you know? So the Late Night News was this show that we wanted to put out that also questioned, like, you know.
Award-winning show.
Award-winning, yes. Yeah. So for me, it was like the ANC is like the representative of all black people. But then we got a question, because remember they had this whole vibe of, we're the kings, we've delivered you from evil, and you can't question us. And we're like, no ways. It's like, and Julius also helped in that, because he was questioning them. But then we were also like, yeah, they all need to be questioned, and the DA and all of that. So it was great for me, like for 5 years, sitting in a room every Friday with, like, you know, people of varying intelligence arguing their point. And then at the end of it,
and try to make it funny. And try
exactly.
You know, because it is funny. I mean, it's ridiculous. Now, if we look back on everything that Jacob Zuma was, and we were really worried about him some of the time,
dude.
People were stressing. I mean, you know, there were good reasons to be stressed. But now we look back on it and we're like, this guy, how did we ever take him seriously?
How crazy is that? Immediately, like that day, we saw that video where he was literally in a corner in that SABC, where he was with his kind of overweight guy. There was this presenter, I don't want to body shame. Yeah, he basically just introduced him, almost like doing a stand-up show. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Zuma. And then that whole thing reminded me of my mom whenever she had come from work, having fought with some of the nurses at work or with my aunt. And then she's always telling the story to kind of be like, I wasn't in the wrong here. Tell me if I was wrong here. And then the way he was even like, I might have been sharp, you know, I might have been use some sharp language and a very, you know, very robust, you know, very rough. I imagine he must have cursed them out, you know.
I would have loved to. I would have paid so much money to be in the room when he and Cyril had that conversation about, okay, you know,
I feel
Baba,
it's gonna come
you
out.
Have to step aside.
I feel it's going to, we're going to hear this kind of, I think you must get Cyril here.
Yes.
And then just say, it's been 2 years, Mr. President, it's been 2 years. Tell us what actually went
here's
down.
Here's the thing about him that I can't understand. And we're jumping around a lot here, but that's okay. So Cyril, clearly, because I thought he was maybe, he'd missed the boat.
Yeah.
There were a couple of occasions where I thought, this guy is, before he was elected and everything, I was like, he's lost it. Mm. He's part of the cabinet that's so rotten. He's been in all those meetings.
Yeah, and also remember the time where we were like, we look to you, Cyril,
and
then he would just
nothing.
Be like, psh, nothing.
Crickets.
Yeah.
But turns out he was playing the long game. Turns out he was smarter than all of us.
Yeah.
And he didn't have to rush, because everything was going to play out the way he wanted it to anyway. So maybe he's way smarter than we give him credit for.
I mean, he wrote the Constitution. Yeah.
And I don't think he's the kind of guy who would, like, spill the beans just to cause some headlines.
You'd be very surprised. I mean, Quincy Jones, baby. Maybe when he's 89. Maybe
that interview?
Yeah, it was really, really rock and roll.
What a life that man has had.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I found myself, I've never been jealous of anyone
in my life.
When he was talking about Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder and all these women.
This is life, man.
This is the life I want.
You know, the thing about, for me, because like Brahue had just passed away, and I had over the past kind of few years had a very close relationship with him. We worked together. We made a comedy show together. And he was like that, you know, because when you sit with Hugh, he would just kind of tell
stories.
You these stories. Like, Hendrix brought me into the room and this happened. And, you know, it's like such a, this big, like you saw when he passed away, like Quincy Jones tweeted. Samuel Jackson tweeted. Roger, you know, now Roger's tweeted. It was just like a big global thing, you know. And his funeral, I mean, the Ghanaian president, it's just, what a beautiful freaking story. What a beautiful guy.
Yeah.
He told about how they've been, you know, he's been friends with Hugh for 50 years. He had flown in just specifically for the funeral, like from the African Union. And he said, 50 years ago, I met this man, Masekela, I like to call him. Not Brahue, I always call him Masekela. And he says, we met in a club, I don't know, in Cote d'Ivoire or whatever. And we were drinking. And we would, after that, it was such a blazing time that we would always, for the next few many decades, we would seek each other out in all these clubs of the world. You know, New York City, Lomé, Paris, London, this, that. And then eventually, at some point, they got joined. Their company was Fela Kuti, you know.
Yeah.
And then he says the two of them. The way he says the two of them were exhilarating company. And then he tells you all these stories. It's just beautifully kind of painted worlds. And then at the end, he made Hugh promise that he would play when he becomes president of Ghana one day. Hugh had to promise to play at that event, you know, at the inauguration. And I remember Hugh said to us when we were shooting, he said he was sick. He said, man, I'm tired, I'm sick, and all of that. We were like, man, okay, Hugh, yeah, I need a rest. And then, okay, Hugh, like maybe not even 24 hours later, we switch on the TV, and on the news is Hugh hand in hand with the Ghanaian president getting down. And I was like...
Well, he had a good reason. He kept his promises.
No, of course. You know, that was just Hugh. You know, that generation
but
of
people.
But
he also had a lot of young, like, you talk about how you worked with Hugh and you used to have conversations with him and he'd tell you stories. He spent a lot of time with young people, kind of letting them know some of the stories they may have missed out on. Because we've heard the political stories, but this was an artist who was carrying South Africa to the world at a time where we were shut off.
Yeah.
And he was bringing some of the world back here. And he was doing it in a very unapologetic, proudly black way.
Totally.
And he did this with a lot of young people. I know a few, you know a few, you are one of them. Mm. And he would spend time.
Yeah. I mean, that was for me what's surprising.
A lot of old people just spend time with old people.
Yeah, but also he didn't like, you know, how South Africa, we have like a reverence, I guess because we're like a conservative culture. We change them, but people like you actually helped change that because we have that reverence for old people. And he didn't like being, because he was in any brainstorm room, in any sort of place, he was the young guy. He was the guy with the youngest spirit, you know.
Well, he wanted to be treated as an equal.
Yeah,
he didn't want you to revere him and
exactly.
to bow and scrape and all that stuff.
Exactly, and also that, you know, like he hated people who grew old before their age. You know, like there were many people where I'd go, what about this guy? What about those people? Be like, why, dude? Why? Those people are so old. I'm like, but they're like the same age as you. He was like, no, it's not the same, you know? And so that, for me, that was the one. And on the radio, like when he passed away, I got a call from a radio, you know, one of those kind of evening hosts on one of the SABC stations. And they were very much like, Ubab Hugh, well, tell us more about your experience as a young person, how it was. So then I start telling these candid stories about Hugh, but then it got a bit too racy, you know, when you go and then Hugh and then you're smelling a bit of weed and they were like, okay, that was Kagiso Rejiga, thank you very much.
You get freaked out.
You know, so yeah, but it was
did
exactly.
Did you see on the night of Zuma's resignation, ENCA sent that reporter out? I'm sure you've seen
that
clip.
Oh, yeah, Bauer.
Nicholas Bauer. And then he was asking people, what do you think of the president's resignation? The one girl goes, oh, motherfucker. And the other one's like, fuck him.
Yeah. He was a motherfucker.
And this is people on the streets of Brom. First of all, what do you expect's going to happen?
On Valentine's Day,
drunk
right?
people, yeah. I mean, what do you think? And then, you know, they always get embarrassed. These traditional broadcasters always get embarrassed when the real people of South Africa have their say, because they want it to appear that we're all, you know, super polite.
Yeah, PC diplomacy, South African.
And we're really not. And that was the truth. That's how people were feeling.
But it's crazy how we know this, and you went in there. It's like the hotbed of like 23-year-olds that are drunk and high. And then you kind of, that reaction that he did, because when that girl in the car said, he's a motherfucker, and then he kind of, he didn't know what to do. And then he went to the next, fuck him.
Gee whiz. Woo! I think he said gee whiz.
I feel like there could have been.
The same goes with Hugh. I mean, Hugh could tell really racy stories because he had some fun times and some wild times. We're talking about clubs all over the world. He was a massive
all manner
star.
Of drugs and women and stuff
big
like that.
Time.
Yeah,
and it's sad to me that we had to always sanitize these things to put them on traditional media. That's why your movies. That's why stuff like we're doing here, where we can have these frank conversations and people don't have to PC themselves, are important. Do you think comedy is safe from those PC people? The ones who want to tell you that it's inappropriate to tell this joke or you shouldn't be talking about those people, and if you make a wheelchair joke, then you're ableist.
Yeah, that's, you know,
you know what
course.
I mean?
I mean, I think that there's a responsibility. I think that people like those are going to be chased out of the, you know, the because comedy happens in comedy clubs, you know, as well. That's where like
it's a pretty rough environment.
Yeah.
I mean, you know from being on that stage, things can go really bad. Crowd they're not forgiving.
No, totally. So I feel like, it's kind of, we need to kind of be responsible and not kind of victimize groups and so on and so forth. But I feel like, you know, for me, it's very important that you are able to make the joke, you know, and we will hold you up. We will come up to you and say, but that was a bit racist, Gareth, or that was a bit sexist, you know, whatever. But if you are aware of those things, I think it makes us cleverer commentators, because if you know that this is where the offense is, and I know I'm going to go in there, but this is how I'm going to come out. For me, it's about coming out. Like what Chappelle's latest show, everybody's been on about, Chappelle. And for me, that was brilliant. That was comedy at its best, you know, because he went in there and we were like, oh my God, he didn't just go in there. But he came out, because when he came out, we were like, he touched. We know that this is, you know, he took a responsible kind of view, but he still managed to do what he was in there to do. He's like an assassin, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You didn't let the kids see the mom getting killed, but you went in there, sliced her neck, still had the ice cream in the fridge and left. And then the kids were still like, oh, mommy's coming back tomorrow. You
know? Well, I mean, I don't know which comedian it was. I heard someone like going at the Me Too thing. And this is touchy territory because there's so many emotions around it. And people are very, very keen to like show that they're upset by stuff. And, you know, he was saying, I'll remember who it was just now, but he was saying he's really upset that he hasn't been fingered in the Me Too controversy. Because he feels he really should be at the forefront of this.
Because he's done some shit.
Yeah. And then you think about things like Louis C.K. and how that's blown up, because he was the comedian for a little while.
I mean, like that Chappelle bit about how where he thinks. I mean, come on, Louis, come on. I'm just because it was like I just find it funny that somebody got freaked out by his friggle dick, you know.
And Chris Rock, have you seen that special?
Yeah, I saw that one the other
day.
What
do you think of that?
I liked it. I mean, I thought it was old school Chris. I feel like Chris is such a like an efficient and effective kind of, you know, kind of transporter of comedy in that way. You know, where somebody like Louis or somebody like Dave Chappelle, they kind of go, come into my lounge, let me tell you something. Yeah, have a bit of a whiskey, let's go. You know, he's smoking, they're kind of like, meh, meh. Whereas Chris is like a preacher, you know, he almost comes in there and he's like, yeah, you know, allergic to food, da 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 da. You know, he's got these kind of clear messages that he, and there was still that vintage Chris. I mean, if I had to critique, which is not what I do in terms of stand-up, there were bits where I was like, oh man, those are silly gags and those are old school, but I feel like all in all it's like unbelievable, like the mastery, like he's one of those, it's like the driver of this Bentley is a pro, as Jay-Z would say.
That's right.
Unbelievable. Yeah,
he's such a pro.
Yeah, that command of, it's just unbelievable, because he's saying, because his stand, he's basically he's saying it directly, you know, where it's like Chappelle, who's one of my favorites. Chappelle is a thought, you know. Chappelle says, and I think maybe he gets a little bit more like ability to even offend because he gets to go, it's a thought. I mean, you can't blame a thought. You can't.
He kind of buys himself,
you know,
some space.
You go in there, yeah.
Wiggle room.
Yeah, whereas Chappelle is like, I mean, Chris Rock is like, boom, this is what's happening, you know. It's like Eddie Murphy. You remember Eddie Murphy? Mick Jagger's an ugly motherfucker.
Yeah.
You can just sing and get pussy. I'm very old school. That stuff would not fly now, but you know, this is crazy stuff.
Oh man, do you look at those guys and does it make you want to do more stand up, or does it make you go, I can focus on the movies without feeling like I'm missing out?
Oh no, I do feel I miss out. I mean, the worst feeling, which you can't get rid of, I don't think you can ever get rid of, is when you go to a show where the guys are killing, are having fun on stage, and you just in the audience. You know,
just drive you crazy.
Yeah, especially when they're really good, and you're like, ah, you know, because that energy is also infectious, so you just want to jump on and do. You know, I remember when I was a younger comic, I'd get to a comedy club and guys would be killing. And comedy was new, so I was a famous guy before I was really, really good. You know what I mean? So I'd rock up into a place because you're just new. You kind of do, because I feel like it takes a long time on stage to be really good. I think if you have like, I don't know, 2 years of like really being on stages, then you can really be good. You know what I mean? But then
you think it's like Gladwell says, the 10,000.
It is, yeah. It's totally that. You know, the more you do, the better. I mean, you must see Lois Ogola now. He's one of my favorite comics. I mean, he's unbelievable, and he's also kind of like sharing ideas. Like his latest show, it's called Unlearning. You must have him here. It's like unbelievable because it's like all these ideas about culture and race and sex and so things that we've learned, but we don't necessarily know the basis off, you know, and then he gives you all of this, breaks it down. It's really, really cool. It's like, it's a one.
I love that when you actually walk out of it and you go, that was not only really funny, but that was brilliant.
Yeah, exactly.
He thought this through, you know, it's almost like a those great movies where it starts somewhere and you're like, I don't know where this is going. Yeah. And then at the end of the movie, it all ties together.
And you're like, wow. Arrival did that for me. I don't know if you saw that Arrival movie with the.
Yes.
Who was the lady who was in it? Arrival was
with that ship that's hovering and she talks to those creatures.
Oh,
and
yeah, that one, the redhead.
I don't know what her name is.
That one was, and Jeremy Renner was the other scientist. Right. It was really, really
good. That was a beautiful movie.
Forrest Whitaker was in there. Unbelievable.
I didn't have expectations of that.
Yeah, because I also went in there, it was like, what's happening? And then by the time it hit me, I was like, oh my God.
Because you also expect it to be a monster movie.
Yeah.
Aliens,
yeah. Yeah. It was really good. That's actually reminded me of that movie. But yeah, so that whole, I mean, we kind of rambling on. It was great. It's great, this ramble.
It's a real conversation.
Check out Loy, please. He's really good.
He's a really good friend of yours, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys spend a lot of time with each other
outside of work, yeah. I mean, we raised him. I always say that Lois Ogola was raised by comedians, but he says that of my son, because there's been all this. Because
how old's your son now?
He's 10. Yeah, he's
I remember
10.
When you just had him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were actually on some rooftop once.
Yeah, I was with you and your wife, and Like a rooftop, and we were talking in about Mabuneng, your kid.
And talking about religion and all of that kind of stuff. I remember that.
We've been around too long.
Yeah. Look, we're still young. Still hang in there, kid. Hang in. I turned 40 in 2 months, 3 months, in May.
Last year for me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, so you, it's almost like there's a railroad.
Do you worry about that? Are you?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of like prep myself, you know, because I was, since my child was born, the biggest thing was mortality, because you get a child and then you start thinking that you're not the main guy anymore. Mm-hmm. There's another guy and mm-hmm. You're the dying one now, you know, that kind of thing. So I dealt with mortality a lot. And myself and Dave, we talked about death a lot. I think we still do. And last year was hectic because my business partner, who is only 33 years old, passed away. Now, like this week,
what
actually
happened?
He just come from Berlin, from the film festival. Very brilliant guy, like super, like ex JP Morgan, super clever.
This?
His name is John Volmink. Mm-hmm. And we had like this awesome meeting, and then we kind of all went our separate ways. It was a great meeting, you know, strat for the year and all. It was now, like this week, or Saturday will be the anniversary of his passing away. So then he decided to walk home, you know. Berlin, his wife said, come on, take a Uber. He's like, no, I'm just going to walk, man. It's a walking world. And then some guy like ran him over.
Oh, you're joking.
Nah.
What a horrible thing to happen.
Yeah. It was crazy. And you know, one of those guys that was really important for many people for purposes of life and work, you know, like one of those guys that everybody assumed was just going to be there for them the whole, you know. And it's crazy. Even now, a year later, you're still going, oh, man. Like, you know, it's
wow.
Crazy.
You know, you think about stuff like that happening and you go, everything is so fragile.
Yeah.
You don't know what could happen.
Yeah.
So when you think about that mortality stuff, then age isn't really a big deal.
Yeah, because Hugh was 78, John was 33, you know, and Hugh, even if when you speak to his son and everybody, he was like, what are you guys talking about? I'm going to be around, man, you know.
Yeah.
When he called me like maybe like four weeks before he passed away, and he was, you know, he was sounding very tired, not like him, you know. And I'd seen him maybe a month or so before that, when he was really thin and all of that kind of stuff. And then so he called me on the phone and he was like, hey man, don't believe everything you hear, man. Don't believe the hype, you know. I'm gonna be fine. I was like, ah, cool, you know. I was just glad to hear him, but he was sound very kind of tired and then kind of speaking a lot of nonsense, just like, you know, this is you. I actually, oh wow, so great, it's December, I gotta just speak with this guy on the phone. And he had this crazy comedy idea and so on. And then at the end, so I was like, cool, so I'll come visit you. And he was like, come any day, man. And then I said, cool. But he said, well, but at the end of this call, man, just don't say sharp sharp, okay? And then I was like, oh damn, you know, like, and that's all I wanted to say. I was just wanted to say, okay, sharp sharp, you know. So I feel like I'm saying sharp sharp now. But so that was also another guy who was close to me who passed away in that kind of way, where we kind of knew it was happening, but then we didn't really. You never kind of ready, you know. And so this whole mortality thing, you kind of keep on thing. And so now I go on about the spirit of Masekela just because of the way he lived. So it's great because he kind of didn't, you know, he took no prisoners. He really kind of lived it hard. And,
yeah. And he could be grumpy.
Yeah. But in terms of his work and his life and his loves and all of that kind of stuff, I feel like when you bounce, when the light finally goes off, it needs to be, you know, like when a show ends, people applaud. That's when, you know. So I feel like that's what people must want to do, is just finish. When their show ends, everybody must stand up and applaud. And there's like 7 billion or 8 billion of us on this planet. So you don't really matter. Make it matter. It's up to you to make it matter. Because otherwise, people die all the time. You know, many more are born all the time. And yeah, you turn 40. There's, you know, I say I have this kind of existential thing. Oh, man, I'm turning 40. And then I meet people who go, wow, you're so young. I'm like, really? Still? You know? And I feel like I'm going to be 60 and people are still going to be going like that. And then I'm going to meet 30-year-olds and I'm going to tell them that, you know? And the one thing about Hugh is he never said anybody was young or old. So that was quite
interesting. Well, he didn't think that numbers mattered in retrospect. You know, it's kind of... When last did you hear from Kibuka?
I don't know, 2 days ago,
yesterday. Oh, so you guys speak regularly.
Yeah.
How's he doing?
He's good. He's
is he enjoying his gig in America?
Big, so what happens is like
He's a big deal.
Yeah, a month ago, 2 months, when is this now? So you know this, the kind of the Daily Africa correspondent.
Right.
So they called me and they're like, yo, Kak, do you want to do, can you do this Africa correspondent thing? And I was like, okay, cool. You know, and it was like this candid call on the phone, Trevor going, yo, man, da, da, da. And then it was, and I hadn't spoken to Trevor in long, but I see Dave a lot. When I go to New York, you know, we kind of walk and talk for long. And then it's like, okay, sweet, see you in a couple of months. And luckily, and he keeps on saying, but you guys, I thought you, you know, I thought I won't be seeing you. You guys are here too much now. But it, because just because of circumstances, we kind of ended up in America a lot. And then just me, you know, be at his house, you know, that kind of. But yeah, they called me and they said, do this Africa correspondent thing. And then that's what, now we sort of work together in that sense. Because we did that first one where Madinga was at the, at the ANC convention, and then you kind of do it in your way, and then you give it to them, and then they have like a whole other team there who, you know, then it's like a very cool, funky way of working, because the way they dissect content and work it is like really great. So for me, it was.
But it's also all these fresh faces on American TV, because they haven't seen any of you before, and this is great, because it means that we get to showcase some of our people. I think from Trevor's point of view and from David's point of view, it allows them to tap into what they know will be very, very fresh stuff.
Yeah.
That I mean, nobody in America has been partial to.
Yeah, there. I mean, Trevor's like a fresh thing. It's like such a fresh thing for the world. It's like crazy when you think, you know what I mean? Like the size of the what he does and what he is and what he represents. I think we kind of maybe isolated, but when you're in America, like I remember I was in America last June, just walking, minding my own business, and like ran, I'm in Beverly Hills. I mean, you think, wow, this is Beverly Hills. You know, I'm like, wow, this is a fancy place. I'm walking down the street and like random people, you know, when you overhear people going, you know that Trevor Noah, have you seen his stand-up comedy? And then they start telling this joke that, you know, and I was like, what? And then they walk, you because you're like, I've just only been in this country for like 24, 48 hours.
You expect them to be talking about, you know, Tom Cruise and Mel Gibson, and there you're hearing a guy who you know.
You know what I mean? And then you see him. Them like chuckle in the distance, like whatever, the punchline just dropped. And there they are. And it's like, you know, he's a big part of the kind of culture there. You know, it's like he is the left. He's like the torchbearer for the left, which is crazy. He's from Orlando.
Would you like a similar situation to evolve for South African film as has for Trevor in South African television, which is obviously translated now into an American show? Would you like that kind of breakthrough for one of your movies?
Yeah, I'd like for South African content, yeah. Not even, you know, television show. I mean, right now, so what we've learned over the past year or two was that transition, you know, because I've always, my business partners have always been trying to make things that are like for the world. So they're not necessarily South African. So I was never like into them, because I was like, yeah, but this is like some movie set in freaking Arizona. I don't, what do I have? I can't add, you know? Yeah. And then they always said, but you're too like insular. Your ideas are too local. They're great, but you're too local. You always can. And I was always like, yeah, I'm about South Africa. Yeah. And even Dave would say, my word, I'm for the world, you know, and then he would be kind of being this for the world. Yo, I'm too stuck in Joburg. My word. And
it's a good David Kabuki impersonation.
So what happened is, then I started thinking, okay, cool, maybe they've got a point. Then I'll make things that are from here, but that where I'm telling my story to the world, like Trevor Noah, like Hugh Masekela, like, I guess, the words are even so abstract, because I'm just like, what do they say? This is no way this anything makes sense. It just sounds.
I don't understand.
Yeah, it's just like, and then it's nice so and catchy, but you're just like, it doesn't make any sense, you know? But then so then I made, like, with Catching Feelings, the first time I saw it play, and it's 4.5 million rand here, but it's like really a $300,000 film. You know? So you get into a festival. Yes, at first it's very arty. There's many films that are like in that price range of, oh, what costs $5 million in America might actually cost five million rand here, and all of that kind of stuff. But then there you'll have some sort of cool indie Hannibal Buress or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
But here you'll have me. So I'm, you know, but then you, but then so there I was like, well, you throw it in there, and then people didn't think of the price when they shot. They were like, wow, great movie, and they reacted to the story. For me, it was a story that's happening in Mavoneng and Melville and all of that type of stuff, but it was a universal story. It was a story of this is the world, you know? Right. But because I was telling it to them. I wasn't just telling it to Johannesburg people in the greater Randburg region. So then for me, that was like an awakening in that sense. Like, just like Trevor, when you hear the stories about how he was, you know, he was kind of trying to pander in the beginning. You do stand up. That was what he thought Americans would want to hear. And then when he started telling his own stories, people were like, whoa, that, tell more of that, you know. And I think with anybody, if a person is from Russia, you want to hear his Russian experience. You want to
sure.
hear and you open it. I mean, like Black Panther this weekend also was a crazy thing because most times you hear about how our accents are too heavy and are this and are that and are, you know, and nobody wants to hear these black narratives and so on and so forth for long everywhere, you know, not just here, everywhere in the world. And then now with that thing, which was, yeah, this mostly has like a lot of broken Xhosa, but these heavy accents, you know, the sort of heavy African accent that you, if you're, you know, if you're trying to break into international media, you're
always trying to break from that.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So this was it's a game changer. So I feel like not just I'd like my stuff to be there, but I feel like somebody, I hope it's me. I hope I'm, you know, I hope it's like, cause I could do with a couple of $1 million, but, but I think that now we are primed. I mean, The Wound was a film that kind of touched a lot of,
correct,
you know, point. It was shortlisted. Like, literally, it was in the top 9 of the Oscars. Like, when they announced the nominees, the makers of that film were there baiting their breath. You know what I mean? That's a big deal, you know? So I feel like, yeah, we're in that place. We're in that time that your stories are, yeah.
I can't wait for that time because I think it's overdue, and I think that we've got very unique ideas and stories,
yeah,
and culture and things that the world is going to be excited to discover.
Totally.
And in the movies you're making, they're getting there. So what I need to ask you though is, are you pissed off with anything at the moment? Because you seem
pissed
quite
off.
Happy. You seem like you
pissed off, yeah.
You're relaxed. You have a good kind of balance going on in your life. Things are working. Anything making you cross?
Yeah, no. I mean, apart from the regular things, you know, prejudice and all of that type of stuff, but that's everybody's thing, you know. I could hit a treadmill a bit more often and all of those kind of, be less on the car. You know, that whole thing, you got to balance all of this kind of stuff.
You don't have any dependencies. Are you a big coffee man?
You know what happens is, well, we got plunger coffee at my house, but then my lady, my partner, she doesn't like. She says it gives her like heartburn for some reason. So we
plunger
end up,
coffee?
Yeah, so we end up having a lot of this
instant
coffee, which is what happened to me. So yesterday I was writing and I realized I had too much of that shit because I woke up with, I was like, whoa, man, I don't feel right. I felt like all acidic.
Like a heart
stuff.
Thing?
I felt like a bit of heartburn or something. I don't know what it is. Gassy. But so I'm going to stop with that. I will hit the treadmill. We got a treadmill in the house, so I'll hit that. I don't know. I can't think of anything that, apart from our national low self-esteem, which we all working on. I mean, you've been working on conquering that, you know, helping us as a nation to kind of crack that. You've done, yeah, you've been like really challenging
to
society.
Like, but I always say that we've got to be more like Nigerians.
Yeah.
Nigerians have no self-esteem problems.
Yeah, of course.
And they've had shit. They haven't had the easiest ride either. It's a harder country to live in than ours.
Mm-hmm.
And people have to fight for their square inch, right?
And they always think we are such sissies, namby-pamby people who just bitch
do,
about everything.
And maybe they're right. Nigerian, they get things done.
Yeah.
And they work hard.
Yeah.
And they're fearless.
Yeah.
And they don't ever sit there and go, I'm not good enough for this. Yeah. They'll tell you they're the best at it, even if they have no idea what they're doing.
In all spheres of kind of human activity, they kill it, yeah.
Yeah, I think we've got to get over our shit now. Yeah. And part of it is also just being, because if you have low self-esteem, if you have no self-worth, then you don't notice it in other people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be, yeah. Then we have this hater kind of culture, right?
Yeah, it becomes which is, like a hater which is culture. What you see on social media much of the time. These nobodies arguing with each other.
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah,
guys, if you stopped arguing, you could be somebody.
Yeah. That's very true. You must, that definitely must be in the cut. Whatever the cut is, you must put that in there.
No, we don't cut this. It goes on live.
Sweet.
Listen, man, you've done such an amazing job, and this writing and producing and directing stuff is such a great next step for you. I'm very excited, and I know that you've been doing it for a while now.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
You're mastering it. No. I think we should all get behind these movies.
Yeah. And 9th of March. 9th of March.
There we go.
And I don't know what you're doing on the 3rd. I mean, I probably shouldn't say this. I'll say this off camera or off live.
Well, then
there's a premiere, the movie premiere. You must come. I don't know if the people of my office got a hold. They were looking for you.
Let your people email my people.
Your people. Because they've been trying to get it. We're like, who's got Gareth Cliff? I think Dave had your old number. I don't know if he's got your
name. I don't leave home anymore.
Yeah, but this will be good. It's like a cool bunch of people. Right. It's like a nice, you know, and it's a cool film. And it's young people and old people.
I gotta put my money where my mouth is. I'll be there.
Yeah, please. Bring a partner. It'll be fine.
I'd be honored, actually.
Yeah, sweet.
All right.
Thank you,
Kagiso.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Always good to see you, man.
Sweet.
Yeah, we're both from Pretoria, huh?
Yeah, of course. I grew up there, man.
Damn right. At Ridgeville.
Yeah, at Ridgeville and Soshanguve and a little bit of Menkies Kop in Acadia, where my parents separated. Divorced.
Oh, yeah?
They ever got properly divorced.
Were they just separated? They never finished the deal?
I don't know. I mean, I don't remember. I think my mom said something a few years ago that, oh, yeah, the paper finally came. But but I think I was 13 when they separated.
Menkies Kop, that's like right at the Union Building.
Yeah, 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 at the bottom. So that's where I met David Carr, the comedian David Carr. I lived on the second floor of a building called Menkies Kop as well. And at the corner of it was Adele's Escort. It was like
a... That's where you and David met.
Yeah, and then he was on the 8th floor or something like that.
Yeah.
And I remember we used to watch Beverly Hills 90210 together. So he would bring his portable radio. And so as the show started, he would start playing the intro sequence as he goes down the stairs, and then he would get into my house as they started speaking in the simulcast. And then we went to UCT together and all of that kind of stuff. So he's also been a friend for a very long time.
Wow, man. Yeah, he's a great guy. I love David.
He's a crazy guy.
He's our Dave Chappelle in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. He's one of those guys. Like Chris Rock. I actually think that he might be. I feel like Loy is more Dave Chappelle in terms of style and what. And David Kao had
That's interesting.
He has Chris Rock meets some Zulu Tswana guy, David Kao. Yeah.
Okay. But David Kao was just pioneered in so many ways.
Dude, I mean, do you know how many places I go?
Maybe he's our Eddie Murphy.
He's our Eddie Murphy. That's our Eddie Murphy.
Now we're talking.
Now you got him. Yeah.
Who are you?
I am
if you had to
Rich
draw
Pryor.
Oh, man. That's the king of all kings.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude, we would not be able to laugh at anything today if it weren't for Richard Pryor.
Yeah, I love Richard Pryor. I mean, I think Richard Pryor is like, well, I mean, that's now being like a very presumptuous, just saying, he just called himself Richard Pryor on national radio. Crazy?
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you, we're talking
about self-esteem.
Self-esteem, yeah, okay, cool. I'll be
Richard Pryor.
I'll be the Jesus then. I'll be the Jesus of comedy in that case, you know, the Nigerian Jesus of comedy.
All right, bro, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to see you.
This was fun, man. You must, if you ever have like things that you want to talk, call me. I'll come in here and I'll just come talk, you know, wax lyrical.
Let's talk a little bit of society, politics, sex, culture, religion, that sort of shit.
Yeah.
I always like talking to you about that. You're
dope.
A thinker.
Yeah, that would be great. We talk about atheism.
There
you go.
I have moved away, by the way, from
atheism.
No, well, not being I'm not one of those... uptight ones who's like trying to tell religious people they're wrong the whole time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That I moved away from.
I like religious people. I just don't believe in it. But I like the good qualities and the good politics of many religions.
Hey, as long as you're not forcing my kids or me or anyone else to have to do what shit you do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can do whatever you like.
But I always tell my, I like Star Wars, I think, is a cool religion. The Jedi,
kind of like this amalgamation. Yeah, of like the balance, the force.
You know what I mean?
Dark
There's
side.
Good vibes in there.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Somebody might find the DVDs 4,000 years from now, and there might be like Jedi's living in. You know what I mean?
They might think this was an actual human civilization.
Yeah, the Force, and their visuals to show. You know, which we don't have.
The Bible.
You know? Yeah.
And the story's more kind of cohesive. Yeah,
there we go. There we go.
All right, man. Thank you.
Sweet. Thank you.
Thanks, Kagiso. This is CliffCentral.com.